Please join me in prayer quickly. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be pleasing unto you, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen.
Amen. Amen.
Please be seated. I want to thank you all for the opportunity to be here with you this morning and speak a little bit about these passages. When Sindra asked me if I'd like to preach, I said, yeah, that would be a lot of fun. She said, look over the lectionary. And I actually chose to speak on today's passages, which might sound kind of odd because, of course, these passages are complicated ones, especially the one we find in our gospel reading today. Talking about the end of the world can instantly mark you as a lunatic or all sorts of other things. But I've always had a special kind of love for these passages, in part because when I was a kid, I was kind of mesmerized by the idea of codes in the Bible that maybe I could crack. That if I could read, I would be the smart one who would somehow figure them out. I was about 10 or 11 at this stage. The thing was, I was growing up in California, where earthquakes, famines, mudslides, fires, pestilence, drought were kind of par for the course. And so as I got a bit older, I started to realize one of two things. Either California was experiencing some serious divine judgment, or trying to predict the end of the world based on biblical passages was a futile endeavor. I'll leave it to you to decide California's current spiritual state. But as I got older, I also started to feel there was a certain kind of cringeworthiness in the televangelists I would see, or the kind of Christian culture around the apocalypse, things like the Left Behind series that is both bad theology and bad literature all at once. And I just started to get really embarrassed about passages like these. I mean, they're not easy things to deal with. I did, however, find hope in things like Isaiah. My husband's Australian, and you will hear me occasionally pronounce Isaiah as Isaiah because of years and years of hanging out with Aussies. So just please forgive me for that. Isaiah 65, I found a lot of hope in passages like that. Here was an end of the world vision I could get on board with, except my lived experience as a human being seemed really, really, really far away from the sort of complete restoration that Isaiah speaks about. A land where the lion and the lamb lie down together feels really hard to imagine, especially in a world that is marked by such deep political, social, religious divisions, systemic injustice, discrimination, poverty. And I started to wonder, what do we do with passages like these? Isaiah might give us the end of the story, but how in the world do we get there? And where is God amid the chaos that we see around us? Seems to me that the disciples in our gospel reading today might have a similar question. We see them talking with Jesus, and when Jesus makes the claim that not one of these stones will stand upon another, the disciples instantly want to know, when will this happen, Lord, and what will be the signs? And it's easy to understand why they might ask that. I mean, the temple is a huge building and sounds like quite an important prophecy. But when we think about it, we need to remember that this is not the first temple. This is not Solomon's temple. This is the second temple. So oftentimes when we think of the temple in Jerusalem, we think of it being kind of akin to the White House or Congress, some sort of massive building that is a symbol of national identity and religious identity. But that's not quite right. Because you see, the second temple, well, it was a bit of an ambivalent symbol for the Jewish people. Not everyone felt that it was legitimate. Because the first temple had been destroyed in 586 by Nebuchadnezzar's army and the Babylonian Empire when they came in. And that led to a period of incredible suffering for the nation of Israel. Judah was led into exile into Babylon. Israel was already in exile in Assyria to the north. It was a time of enslavement, a time of mass execution, a time of families being ripped apart, and then years and years and years living away from home. So the second temple was then rebuilt by Cyrus the Great, and then built into its big sort of vision by Herod. Not exactly God himself, either one. And so some people, like the Essenes, had pulled out into the desert, going, we don't want anything to do with that. And others, you know, well, it's the best we have, so we'll make do with it. But either way, the prediction that not one stone would stand upon another, that's not just the destruction of a massive building or the destruction of a national emblem. That speaks to this deep national trauma. This has happened before, and it was horrible. And so when Jesus says not one stone will stand upon another, the disciples naturally want to know, when is this going to happen? And how will we be able to avoid this? Right? Tell us the signs so we can get out of here. And I think that's a really natural response when we feel like there is some sort of doom coming our way. We want to know how to avoid it. And that's exactly what the disciples are asking here today. Jesus doesn't actually answer their question, I think. I think he answers a different question. It's easy to get caught up in Jesus' images and to start thinking that he's going to give us a timeline. But I think he's answering the deeper question of where God might be amid that sort of suffering. Now, Jesus' images of the end of the world are quite iconic. Fires, wars, rumors of wars, kingdom rising against kingdom, fires, earthquakes, pestilence, famine. And if that can sound very scary, but if we sit with those images for a minute, what we start to realize is that that is exactly the world we find ourselves in today. There is the big impersonal stuff, wars and rumors of wars, Syria, Turkey, the threat of geopolitical disaster from North Korea, or political unrest in Venezuela, climate change, fires burning in Australia right now, fires in California, drought, earthquake in Indonesia just yesterday. All of these things are part of our natural, real-world experience of the big impersonal forces that are always coming against us, it seems. But then Jesus moves into the interpersonal. Families deeply divided, betraying one another. Fathers, brothers, sisters betraying each other. He talks about being handed over to the synagogues and the governors. This is being handed over to the religious authorities. This is all too familiar a story today. Families divided by politics, families divided by their understanding of faith, by their understanding of what it means to follow Jesus. We don't have to look too far. In fact, we can see it right here in the city of Newburgh. Church communities divided by what it means to follow Jesus. And what's interesting is amid all of this chaos, Jesus promises his disciples this: "For I will give you words and wisdom when they bring you before the councils." I will give you words and wisdoms. And that passage stopped me because I was thinking about it and it occurred to me that if he will give us words and wisdoms, well, that means he is with us amid these big impersonal forces that are coming against us and amid those personal senses of destruction and opposition. But he's not just with us. He's actively for us if he's giving us words and wisdom. He's not just standing there suffering with us and, yeah, this is horrible. He is actively doing something on our behalf. God isn't just with us in the chaos, but he is actively for us. Now, I want to be really clear here. I am not saying that this is like an anti-intellectual passage. You know, don't worry about preparing anything. He's just going to give you words. No. I don't think that's the point of this passage. And it's not an invitation to see persecution everywhere. But I think what it does do is it acknowledges the real world betrayals that we experience and the real fears that we feel when we look at the state of things today. And it says, you don't need to worry, because I will be with you, and I will be actively for you amid the chaos. Now, this isn't the only place that we see this promise. Of course, when we turn to Isaiah 65, we see it again. And this is a beautiful passage, but it's also a haunted passage. If we look at it, one of the things that we see is that it is a passage haunted by loss. Never again will there be in it infants who live but a few days. If you're imagining a world where infants live more than a few days, the unspoken trauma is the infants that only live a few days. Never again will they build houses and others live in them, or plant and others eat. This is that suffering that comes from feeling that your work is completely futile, building houses, and then being sent away, being kicked out of your communities because of war, because of suffering. Again, that is the reality that haunts this passage. Nor will they bear children doomed to misfortune. Is to have a deep sense that your children must be doomed to misfortune if you're imagining something else. And then it also imagines a God who might answer us, a God who will speak before we even ask. But that's one of the most interesting parts, because before they call, I will answer. While they are still speaking, I will hear. The speaker of this passage is God. This isn't coming from a prophet or a dispossessed people. Who is it who is haunted by the brokenness of the world? Who is it who sees the horrors going on and is imagining a different world? It's God. God doesn't just watch. God is actively for his people, imagining and planning and creating a new heavens and a new earth where the former things will not be remembered, nor will they even come to mind. So often healing doesn't look like what we want it to. There's the mental illness that we manage, but it's always there, gnawing away at our joy. There are the memories of abuse, of assault and discrimination that wake us up, nightmares always present in the middle of the night. And there's the sharp reality of loss that cuts so deeply, especially as the holidays come around again each year. But the end of the story isn't a second temple that reminds us of everything that we've lost. It isn't a future flourishing that is made bittersweet by the memory of what's been replaced. The end of the story begins with a God who rends the heaven and comes down among us, a God who takes on flesh, a God who suffers with us and for us, a God who faces darkness and brokenness and evil on our behalf. The end of the story begins with a God who takes our scars and makes them his own. This God with us, this Emmanuel, he promises a healing in Isaiah 65 so complete that the former things aren't even remembered. They don't even come to mind. Instead, the God who sees, this God who is with us and actively for us amid oppression and division and suffering, this God will heal our deepest wounds and make all things new, even us. Amen. Amen.